Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. This is your host, Veronica Monet, and, you know, tonight's topic might be a little out of the box for some of us here. Exactly what would induce shame in you if you were a CEO or a CFO and you were pursuing your profession with a spiritual center or focus? I think sometimes we do get shamed for being spiritual, especially when it's in the context of anything to do with mastery or money. My guest tonight is Alan Shelton, and he's author of a book called Awakened Leadership Beyond Self-Mastery. It just came out last month, as a matter of fact. And he's a well-known strategic advisor and leadership coach. He has experience in the so-called hard metrics of business, and he works with executive teams that demand a drilled-down understanding of operations and finance. He specializes right now in one-on-one coaching with senior management and has worked with clients such as BF Corporation and University of San Diego. Alan, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone.
Thank you.
And where are you located tonight? I'm just trying to get a sense of what part of the U.S.
I live in Oceanside, California, which is the north end of San Diego County.
You must be having
an old firehouse. The first firehouse in Oceanside, I turned it into my house and office.
Okay. And I'm assuming it's just beautiful and tropical down there.
It is. The only thing that may happen, you may hear a train go by occasionally, because if you live in Southern California near the beach, they decided that's where the train should go as well. So occasionally a train goes by.
Yeah, very strange. Well, it seems like it might be a little bit of a hard sell in this time, this day and age of the bottom line, where most people are interested in the numbers, not really seeming to be interested in the people. I mean, there's a lot of lateral movement now. People used to work their way up the ranks. Now they work their way from company to company, and a lot of companies don't seem to have much loyalty towards their employees anymore. And I'm wondering if you have found any resistance to this idea of awakened leadership.
You know, I really haven't. What's really interesting is that the way you describe it is from the outside, and I think it looks that way from the outside.
Uh-huh.
But the reality is, and I'm sort of an example of that, I'm somebody who was a seeker, if you will. I went to India, spent time in an ashram. I mean, one of the things that interests me in what you do was, you know, if you read the book, I in the ashram I actually facilitated and did tantra work, and so I was in a very sexually open atmosphere. And the purpose of that was to be able to look at your own conditioning. And it was a beautiful opportunity to do that. And what I found out was that migrates back into the corporate world. And really, the corporate world, there are two things going on. One of them is there are a lot of people who feel this internal pull, and they don't know quite what to do with it. And so leadership is sort of the secret word or the place that we get to actually, you know, have a wider lens about what we do with people or engage in personal development. And, you know, the other thing that's happening is that if you go out and look on Facebook or in the social media, the younger generations, not just the youngest one, but there's two or three of them, and they're taking a stand about having life be about something bigger than themselves. That's what you read, you know, on Facebook. They talk about sustainability and recycling and all of the things that they talk about. But because of social media, they've been able to make that stand actually count. And corporations are starting to pay attention to that and go, wait a minute, this is where our next leaders are coming from, and we better be competitive. And if we're going to be competitive, we better deliver some of what these people are asking for. So the reality is that what I do, which is a very spiritually based exercise, it actually nests. I can make it sound a lot more mainstream by using the words of what they call developmental theory, but it's the same thing. And so you and I can talk about it as though it were a spiritual journey and nobody cares. But when I'm in a corporate boardroom, there's a whole, you know, new set of languaging, but it basically points to exactly the same journey.
So, and what is that languaging then? Is it more about sustainability and I don't know.
No, I mean, here's an example. You know, you and I might use the word vulnerability as an example. And in corporate speak, you would never say vulnerability. You would say something like transparency. If you and I wanted to talk about the intuitive, for instance, the word that we use in the corporate world for that is a gut feel. So someone who is highly developed as a executive and as a leader usually is said to have an incredible gut feel about things. And as I said, you and I would say, oh, I see, they're operating, you know, they've learned to operate from a much more intuitive place. And so the actual journey is the same. It's just whether or not you can place it in a context that people can hold on to in the corporate world.
So it sounds like you've really got this dialed in. I love that. You've got a formula. But, okay, so getting past the languaging then, the reason the corporations are starting to pay attention to this in their recruiting is because most of the younger executives that are coming in have got more social consciousness than perhaps some of their predecessors. Am I understanding it correctly?
That's true. And because of that, in some ways, some of the older managers are going, hey, wait a minute, if we're gonna widen our lens, you know, I've always had this sort of inner pull that I'd like to know what that's about as well. So you see that it's happening from both ends, and they look out there and they go, oh, you know, there's this thing called developmental work or inner work. And it's about looking at your unconscious patterns. Now, you and I would say you want to look at your unconscious or reactive patterns or, you know, behaviors, if you will, because those are blocks in the way of our spiritual journey. I mean, how can you be about serving others if your own unconscious patterns keep you from doing that? And so there's a, you know, we labor under a service sort of a sense of things. But if you flip that over for a minute and say to somebody, well, you know, your passion in life is to develop these incredible outcomes. Most corporate people, it's like they do what they do because they think they're climbing the mountain. And if you say to them, well, do you want your own unconscious behavior to get in the way of your most passionate activity? And they'll say, oh, no, I don't want it to. And so the answer is the same. It's just what you hook it to. And,
sure.
And so what you're starting to see is that, you know, the corporate world actually is starting to listen to the spiritual world. And the spiritual world's looking out there and going, well, hey, you know what? I don't mind climbing a mountain or two. You know, there's nothing particularly wrong with that. You know, that old saying, praise Allah, but tether your camel. And so, you know, the spiritual types are going, well, we could use some tethering of camel help. And the people who know how to tether camels are going, well, wait a minute, there's this other side that's really cool and expansive, and we'd like to engage in that. And so right now there's a, you know, there is a demand. You know, the corporations that I work in are some of the most mainstream companies that there are. But they're very interested in tapping into people's passion and giving them the opportunity to expand themselves internally. Because there's an underlying belief that it'll make them better leaders within those companies. And you and I both know that while that's true, that once you're on the path, so to speak, you don't control how the pull happens. And so, you know, you always get, as a seeker, you always get into it thinking, well, I think I know what I'm doing here. And then once you're into that journey, you really don't. You have no idea what you're up to. And so, you know, the spiritual journey and even the, you know, the kind of work you do where you take a look at your, you start to become comfortable with your own body and your own conditioning. And the idea that shame isn't there is exactly and squarely in this kind of a process.
Well, now, I understand you are helping the CEOs and CFOs. Are those the only populations that you work with, by the way?
No. A week before last, as an example, I facilitated a what they call an internal leadership institute. And so this particular client of mine picked 32 what they considered to be their emerging leaders, and
yeah.
I spent a week with those 32 leaders. I was one of four faculty, but the four of us created a week-long process wherein these people, you know, were able to spend time looking at themselves, looking at their own internal behaviors. And they were people that did things all the way from social media, customer service, supply chain. There were some financial people in there, some sales people. You know, of the 32 people, they actually came from, you know, quite a population. There were six that were international that had come, two from Panama, one from China. And so, you know, there was quite a cross-section. And so the programs that are being created in the corporate world would probably surprise a lot of people, because there's an impression that they don't, that that's not happening. But the reality is that people who are, you know, impassioned about things, you know, carry that into work, and believe it or not,
sure.
The environment in those companies start to trend in that direction.
Well, this is all fabulous good news, and I'm just wondering, what exactly, I mean, what are your methodologies? Do you give inspirational lectures? Do you teach workshops? Are you teaching actual techniques?
No, I mean, typically what happens is that, you know, depending on how you structure it, usually you will do days of group work. So typically you can take a group of people and you can start to introduce them to the idea that the life journey is one of conditioning, and that through our conditioning we develop certain assumptions and beliefs. You know, as I say, you dabble in the sexual area, and you know how damaging holding certain assumptions about sexuality can be in terms of how they play in your life. And so can the other behaviors. And so as you introduce people, you can introduce that as a group. And then normally what you'll do is you'll have people actually do a little bit of do some inquiry and some testing. They'll actually possibly take a 360 profile or something along that line. And then you begin the one-on-one trek with them, where in a one-on-one format, you start to let them actually look at their own behaviors. And there are things that they probably haven't seen before, didn't even know existed. They just were acting out unconsciously or reactively. And so it's their first, it's their first experience doing that. A lot of people who are in the more spiritually oriented world, you know, we do that all the time. It's something that we're used to doing, you know, calling things on ourselves, telling people what their trips are, however you want to phrase that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the corporate world, there's not as much of that available, but people have a hunger for it, and they start to go, oh, I can see where that gets in my way. Well, you know, if it gets in the way at work, it gets in the way at home. There's not a boundary line about, oh, gee, we're dealing with corporate behavior, not personal behavior. All behavior is personal. It's just a matter of where it takes place. And so if you're working on someone's unconscious or reactive patterns, they are theirs. They've been developed in that person through their conditioning, and a time has come where they get to look at it. And so, so that's exactly the work we're doing. It was interesting, the way I figured out that the corporate work was actually energetically the same was that I had facilitated primal and tantra groups in the ashram that I lived in for years. And when I came back to the corporate world and I started to do these things, it was like, this is the same thing. We're just using different words, you know. And that was the genesis for the book, because upon that discovery, I was like, you know what, I have something to say here. I've actually spent more time in process than most of these companies have ever seen. And so here's an opportunity for someone who has a corporate background to spin a story or tell a journey that would be palatable to the corporate types. If you, and that's India included. I mean, if you are situated in that world, there's a credibility factor that people will allow you, and your story then actually can flow into that space.
Huh. Well, I noticed that you talk about taming the urge to do, not
yep.
be. Do you,
yep.
And you work with different kinds of audiences. Have you found one audience to be more resistant to that than others, or are they all about the same?
Well, you know, taming the urge to do is a thing that starts to happen on the arc of everyone's path. So, you know, you start as a child and you're taught that you are the autonomous doer of all things, that, you know, you control everything that is. If what you say is, I'm going to drive my car down the street, then you're in charge of actually doing that.
Right.
And in the mind, you think that's how it actually happens. What you have to do to get there is ignore all the stuff that doesn't work. So if somebody gets in the way while you're driving your car down the street, you don't get to do that. But the mind still says, no, I'm in charge. And so we all learn that at a really early age. And then the next bridge that we cross is the bridge of, you know what? I'm thinking that maybe my activities are interwoven and part of an interconnected whole, that they arise when they're called out rather than when I decide. In fact, as a human being, I might not even be smart enough to understand when my actions need to be called into play. And so what people do is they start to understand that, and I would tell people that the highest form of leadership is standing in availability to the call that will naturally arise. Now, that's also the highest level of service. It's the highest level of divinity. It's the highest level of a lot of things that you and I might talk about. If you look at the male-female model,
Alan.
It's the highest in Tantra. That's the role you play. You stand in availability for the call. And,
I have a question for you, Alan.
Huh?
Or maybe it's an observation, but this is beginning to sound like it's got a few elements of 12-step in it. Does it?
A few elements of what?
12-step recovery.
You know, interestingly enough, I always looked at it in reverse. That the if you look at the ancient prophets and masters, and you know, you can pick them, and so can I, Buddha, you know, pick them out.
Mm-hmm.
That what they had to say about understanding that we all live in surrender to what is, that the 12-step program was bright enough to understand that was what needed to be in place for someone to actually move past addiction. So I there's no doubt that those are exactly the same principles.
Well, certainly this whole thing about letting go and getting into the flow
yep.
reminds me of step 3. And then, of course, you've got this overlay of service, which is step 12. So, absolutely. But I do think that's proven itself to be a pretty successful model for a lot of people.
Well, I think the reason it is because it's the, you know, in essence, it's a model of expanded human behavior where there is something that's quote-unquote bigger than me that's at play. And you know that when you're in addiction, the only thing that matters is you. So, so the whole basis of the spiritual journey and the whole basis of moving past addiction are actually rooted in exactly the same essence, if you will.
And well, Alan, I mean,
I agree with you. I was just pointing out that I'm guessing that Buddha was around before the 12-step program. But
I think so.
I was being cute. I'm sorry.
No, be cute. Be cute. We like cute on this in the Shamefer Zone. Absolutely. But I'm just wondering if you're talking about addiction. Have you seen any leaders who maybe are addicted to power or money or work? And do you ever have to contend with that?
You do. And that actually is probably the hardest thing that I face, or I think people who do what I do face, and I think it's the hardest thing that any facilitator of any process faces, and that's always the outlier in any given group, because if someone is thoroughly embedded in their own ego process, and they aren't in touch, for instance, with their own internal movement to move out of that, their ego demands or their ego desires cover any of their awareness of what's underneath, then that's a hard nut to crack, and it also can be very influential on a group. And normally what you try to do in that case is you try to move that person into the hands of someone who can deal with them one-on-one. And in leadership context, what's starting to happen is that it's seen in a corporate context, in an organizational context, that if you're working as a team member, then you need to be in a service modality. And people are starting to pick up on that and understand what that means on the ground. And so people that are very, very focused on only that, they're starting to stick out in companies that embrace that. And I'm not saying they all do. I mean, there still are some of the old companies that you described that, you know, are out there for just themselves, and they do exist. But those aren't the environments that you see the kind of work that I'm talking about happening within.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, you talk about having the courage to be vulnerable.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder, what do you think that means for the average person, whether they're a leader or not? Just anybody. I mean, parents are the leaders of their children, right? So what does it mean to have the courage to be vulnerable?
Well, I think the first thing that, you know, that people don't understand is that an attempt to project an image of who you are that is something that you yourself really can't do always leaves a gap that you have to protect. And we learn that the image we project is how people are going to judge us. And so based on that early behavioral conditioning, we start to, you know, weave our stories about who we are. And pretty soon that becomes a lifetime engagement. If you walk into a, you know, I dare anyone, walk into a local restaurant, listen to what people are saying, and 90% of what they're saying is explaining to the other person they're talking to who they are and how they're built and what they do. You know, humanity is in a constant...
There's that train you talked about.
There's my train. There they go. I love it.
What a contrast. San Diego is so beautiful and gentle,
so,
and all of a sudden the train.
There it is. So anyway, I mean, that's what people do, is they spend a lifetime doing that. Well, pretty soon they don't notice that's what they're doing. They just do it automatically. It's unconscious. They walk around and they pretty much, you know, live in a place where they spend all of their time telling everybody around them how it is that they should be viewed and seen. You know, that's what they work on. And it takes some courage to look inside and go, you know, I think this whole system might be a little off here. I think the fact of the matter is that every single human being I hang around seems to have a few holes. You know, they got some good stuff, but they got some bad stuff. And that's just the basic composition of people. And, you know, I think rather than holding up and making, you know, all of this effort to hold up an image that covers all of those bad spots, maybe I'll just admit that the bad spots exist, and we'll start from there and see how it goes. And I do think it takes, and that's what vulnerability is, if you think about it. It's simply saying, this is who I am. You know, in the book, I don't know if you know, there's a story where I'm in a group called Acceptance, and you're supposed to call the worst thing out about yourself. Well, the worst thing about me, looking at the dark side, was that I was an unconscious, habitual liar.
Wow.
That's not probably something you want to say about yourself all the time. And as I examined it, it was no surprise. I had spent my entire life in business, and you know, most business people, you know, when they're trying to sell or do whatever they do, they're managing stories. And that's a nice way of saying, you know, they're unconsciously and habitually posturing in a certain way to get things done. And I guess if you go one level below that, unconscious habitual liar is what that is. And so in this particular group, unbeknownst to me, they asked us to come up on stage and with microphone in hand and announce what our worst attribute was. And I thought, I was the first one called, and I gulped and said, oh, my God, I don't know. And then at the last minute, they said, oh, by the way, take your clothes off. So here I am in front of 36 people, 28 of which, if I remember right, were very good-looking women. And I had to take my clothes off, hold a microphone on a stage, and announce that I was an unconscious habitual liar. Now, that was, for me, an incredibly vulnerable moment.
And
as you can imagine, it took a fair amount of courage to, you know, walk this Irish body up on top of that stage and make those statements. But you know, that was an incredible learning about acceptance, and it was really amazing. What happened in the room was that all of a sudden everybody was incredibly close to me. Yeah, because they could look and go, well, of course, you know, this is his thing, and we have our thing, and he's just human, and we're just human, and we all possess these things called, you know, the shadow side or the dark stuff or whatever, and it's that, you know, pretending that stuff isn't there that gets us in trouble, and it does take some courage to say, you know, I'm not going to live that way anymore. And then the vulnerability is what you hope follows from that first insight.
Wow. So it's like, you naked up on the stage admitting to a problem sounds like the most austere fifth step in the world. And for our listeners who don't know what a fifth step is, it's when you are working your steps in AA or Al-Anon or whatever close to you happen to be in, and you admit the nature of your wrongs, the things that you've done, the character defects that you have, to usually a sponsor. A lot of times people do it with their sponsors. But, my God, whose idea was that to say get
naked? Well, that's just it's part of a process called acceptance. It was an 8-day group. And, you know, we spent the first 3 days, we spent actually coming up with these things, you know, and we would write them on a big poster, and then the people who were facilitating the group would come by and go, no, that's not good enough. Find something better than that. There's something darker in your soul than that. And so we would take the poster board off the wall and we'd come up with a new one, you know, and after about 3 days, That was when I think on the fourth day was when we did this particular exercise. But it was a whole process, you know, aimed at learning just to be able to say to yourself or accept yourself for what you are without having to prop that story up, without having to say, oh, This Alan Shelton guy, he's this bright corporate guy that goes around and does all of these wonderful things. It's true that I work in the corporate world, and it's true I have success in the corporate world. But there's also some other things about, you know, Alan as a, you know, as an individual that aren't so nice. You know, you could call my daughter and she'll give you a list. But but the reality is that actually seeing them for yourself is just incredibly powerful.
Right.
Because when you sit in front of somebody and you're actually there to serve them, you no longer have to worry about what it is that they might see through relative to you, because if they want to know that, you tell them in a second. And so the power lies in the fact that there's nothing to hide, and you've already called probably much worse things on yourself than anybody else is going to dream up for you.
Well, it's so true. Now, you are often quoted as saying there's a difference, that there's no difference between leadership and personal maturity. Can you explain that?
Well, the reason I say that is that the leaders in leadership development theory have come to the conclusion that the arc of a human life is one built in stages of what they call adult maturity. And you can go out and read books by, you know, the famous leadership author, Robert Keegan of Harvard, or Bill Torbert at Boston College, and there's others. And that's what it's called maturity continuum theory, that there is a natural arc that a human being is being pulled through, and that there's an actual yearning that exists in a human being that wants to move through that arc of maturity. And that is what makes up what we call developmental leadership. And what my contribution, I think, was that I wrote this book about being a corporate guy that had to go to India and had to do processes and things outside of the corporate world to be able to move through those stages. Because the old world didn't really allow for that. It wasn't something that it was embraced. And today, that's actually the prevailing leadership theory. And it's the same exact thing as the path of awakening or the path of enlightenment or the spiritual path. Pick your nomenclature in terms of language. And what is interesting to me is that, you know, I wrote the book, and Georgetown and Notre Dame, the first two schools that looked at it, and there have been several others since, are using the book to give to people to say, this is what it's like to be in an actual developmental leadership process. This is what it looks like. This is what it feels like. And they're giving them a story about some guy who launched off to India and hung around in the ashrams and did process work. But the reality is that's what has been migrated into, leadership processes as they're starting to, you know, become implanted in the corporate world. And that's the kind of work we're doing out there.
So it kind of sounds to me like, just like alternative modalities like acupuncture, most people can get acupuncture treatments now through their insurance, which is very mainstream indication.
Yeah.
But it didn't always used to be that way. It used to be that it was considered something from the East that was very foreign and not as effective as our scientific Western culture, and it sounds like that you are helping to bring philosophies and behaviors in from the East into our Western culture.
And my wife, as an example, is a yoga therapist and currently studying with a shaman, and she runs a cancer recovery program and deals with PTSD. And the people who she sees in those programs are all, you know, the federal government, the Marines who do the PTSD work are covered through military, and the cancer recovery people are covered through insurance. And so they come and they do you know, yoga, and she does Reiki and all of the healing kinds of things that a lot of people do, and that's all considered, you know, part of a normal program of recovery. And so you're seeing, you know, you are seeing an expansion in those areas, the healing areas for sure, and now you're starting to see some amazing breakthroughs on the corporate side where people are saying, you know, I want something bigger. Yes, I'm a corporate person. Yes, I enjoy climbing that mountain, but my life is not going to be lived in the narrow frame. I want a broader frame to live it. And so it's starting to be seen that these are just programs that a company, you know, should offer for the benefit of both the company and the people themselves. And yeah, so that's clearly, and I think it matches with what you just said. It's interesting that it mirrors, you know, you can look in any segment of society and go, you know what, there's some expansion going on here.
And I think there is too, I really do. And it's fabulous and refreshing to hear that this is taking place in corporate environments too. What is the difference between reactive behaviors and responsive behaviors?
Well, reactive behavior is, that's another one of those words that I find that we use in leadership that actually means unconscious behavior.
Okay.
So a behavior that's reactive is triggered by an outside event that happens automatically. So someone walks up to somebody in a bar and says whatever they say, and without really noticing, the person reacts and does whatever they do, anything from verbal to physical, but it all happens by itself. That's a triggered automatic behavior. A responsive behavior is a behavior that you are aware of. And actually, normally you would want to think that you're standing in availability for whatever the behavior should be, and that you're
right,
aware and conscious of the call for the behavior that's being emitted in any given moment. So that would be the way that you would look at a responsive behavior. You actually know what you're doing.
Yeah, well, it's similar to what we teach in anger management, and I'm wondering how you teach your clients to be more responsive and less reactive.
Well, a big piece, when it comes to the unconscious, most unconscious behavior is, it moves through simple awareness. I mean, if you think about how unconscious behavior works, you do it, and you don't have any idea why you do it. You just know that every time something happens, you seem to be responding in a certain way. So when you start to look at your own patterning, you can start to say, oh, okay, well, you know, and I mean, we can get really deep on this, but, you know, I was beaten in a fairly heavy-handed way as a small child, and you know what, that created a certain reaction to this kind of a circumstance, and whenever kind of that circumstance happens, that's the reaction, because, you know, the conditioning in this particular body is to, you know what to do when that's coming at him. So everybody has whatever their design is from having learned behaviors to respond to things. The thing that happens is that you have to realize that, you know, younger behaviors are built on the concept that survival is at stake, and it very well might be. Most of the time when people enter into their adulthood, they no longer are in that particular position. So their behavior can change, and there's an environment for their behavior to be changed within. It's just that if it remains unconscious, it doesn't change. And so really the first step is awareness. Now, when you start to talk about anger management, you know, a lot of times some people's conditioning and experience is just so intense and so global that really, you know, they belong engaged for a long period of time in just unearthing what it is that drives all of that. And I actually believe that a lot of anger management falls short, not because it's not good It's not a good approach. It's not given the space and time it needs to really cover the whole subject. Because as Americans, we're like, I'm going to go do anger management for an hour. Well, that's great unless you need 5 hours.
It's true. So
we sort of have this thing in our head where, you know, hey, you get an hour of anger management. It's like, well, you know, okay, I hope I'm a 1 hour case because that's what I'm getting. You
know? Ellen, what was it that took you to the ashram, and where was this? This was an Indian ashram?
It was. When I hit my mid-30s, I was very successful in the corporate world. And probably if you had said, here are the things you need to do in order to be a successful whatever, I had done those things. If my mom and dad had given me that list, I think I had it covered. The only problem was that I looked inside and I was just absolutely miserable. And it didn't make much sense to me that you could check the entire list of stuff you were supposed to do off, and yet you walked around in this sort of state of misery, as it were.
Uh-huh.
It was just a very pervading sense of things. And so there was an intuition that said, you know, there's something more, and you need to find out what that is. And so I think at that point in time, I officially became what they call a seeker. And so you'd find me hanging around in the metaphysical bookstores, and I'm reading, you know, The Course on Miracles and Carl Jung and the deconstructive philosophers and, you know, whichever Eastern saint I could get my hands on and whichever Western saint I could get my hands on. It didn't matter to me. I was reading. I was trying to find it all.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that at one point in time I happened to run across some stuff. I had isolated it down to the fact I knew that it was the way that we believed and held the ego, that,
uh-huh,
that there was something in that. I didn't know exactly what, but I'd sort of gotten it down to that. And so I said to myself, well, that's where you need to go look. You need to go find people who really understand how to unwind the ego, because if anybody has a bunch of ego, it's pretty clear I do. So this is a pretty, you know, I knew I was a pretty, you know, shaped ego. I had that nailed down. So I was like, all right, let's go take a look at that. And I just happened to run across, you know, some of the Indian masters, and they really dealt with that as an issue. And I found out that there was an ashram near Bombay, and you could actually go stay there for long periods of time. And so I spent the biggest part of 3 years in that ashram meditating and doing process work of the kinds I've described to you. I spent about a year and a half doing a lot of my own work, and then I actually became a facilitator for a lot of those groups after that.
You've got an amazing background. I mean, you actually also were a Mormon missionary.
I was. Right? Yeah, my mother converted when I was 7. So at the age of 19, as expected, I got sent off on a Mormon mission, and my country was Peru. So I spent 2 years in Peru and learned to speak Spanish in a very incredibly good way. And when I started my career at Pricewaterhouse, they found out I spoke Spanish, and so they made me a merger acquisition guy, and I did deals in South America. So all of it, it all sort of fed on each other. And then I started my own company, and you know, by the time I was 37 or 36, I had gotten to that place that I told you where I had done everything I was supposed to do, and that was when the serious seeking started. And all I've really done now is come back to the corporate world and said, you know, gee, there are a lot of people like me who live in this world who, given the chance, would like to engage in this kind of internal work. And, in fact, a lot of companies are platforming it for them. And so I've just taken my own spiritual journey and migrated it and packaged it for the corporate world. And the corporate world actually has a place for that to happen. So my story is interesting. You know, it's just like every other seeker's story. It's just I went back to the world I came from.
Oh, it's fascinating, actually. Usually when you read a book that's telling business people how, I mean, I've gone through a lot of training actually in corporate America over the 10 years between college and becoming self-employed. And that this book doesn't read like a corporate manual. It reads more like a memoir. I mean, it's, you know, not every part of it, but you've got some very interesting stories here, including something about being in Peru with a machine gun firing overhead.
Yeah, well, they at the time I was there in Chile, just next country down, they assassinated a fellow called Allende, and of course the Americans had a lot to do with that, and so political tensions were fairly high in the little corner of the world that I was living in, and so we got to see lots of tanks and guns and machine guns and all the like. One of the cities actually down there tried to secede, and so the government of Peru had to come in with all of their forces and stop that from happening. So yeah, I was there for all of that, kind of excitement as a tender 20-year-old boy from Southern California. So it certainly was a shock. It was a shock and a surprise because I had never seen anything quite like that in my life. I had grown up in the 60s and had seen some of the protests here, but real live military action was a whole nother league of fun. So, here's something that's interesting. The reason I wrote the book in stories was that the normal corporate learning is to learn diagrams and models and steps, and you memorize or you hold those things as though they're meaningful or true. And in a journey, every person's journey is their own. And the best that you can really do, I think, is to tell your story and hope that somebody else will recognize the energy of that story and be able to stand in it as though it was their own and take something out of it for their own journey.
Sure.
And so I wrote the book purposefully in the way that I did, with the idea that as people read it, they would go, oh, he's talking about something different. He's talking about inner work, and that journey is unique to every single person that undertakes it. But the stories feel familiar. This feels pretty familiar. I think I understand what he's pointing to. He's pointing to something that is in his life, and it'll be similar in my life, but it'll be different in terms of how I would describe it. So that's why I wrote the book that way. And I've had the interesting thing is that the people in that world are like, it's so refreshing to read a book that reads, you know, that's interesting and it has stories in it. And I chuckle at that because
it's fabulous. I have to read a paragraph here from page 84 because it's just so much fun. It says, as for our missing missionaries, they had returned to the home where they were lodged as soon as they saw helicopters firing over our section of town. The safety of our whole contingent was somewhat inaccurately credited to me as their leader, and soon afterward I was called to be a branch president of a congregation in a mountain town of some 30,000 souls. A branch president in Mormon terms is roughly the same as a pastor or a bishop, depending on what denominations we're talking about. So in this town called Puno, or Puno, on the shores of Lake Titicaca, it was thrust into yet another new environment, having inherited a congregation of about 200 people and the responsibility for the religious life of not only families and missionaries, but also possible converts. And it was during this time that I was called on to excommunicate a member of the church for blasphemous writings. Not exactly what you would expect to find in your typical handbook for executives. I think it's fabulous that you brought all these things in here. And you have a life that reads like a movie, too.
Yeah. So. Well, there's a funny story that goes with that if you want to hear it. I was in India one time, and we were in a group, and they were talking about certain feelings. And they said, what does that feel like? And I raised my hand, and I said, well, that feels like when you're in a court tribunal and you excommunicate someone. And the old wise man at the front of the room, he goes, oh, he says, you mean like in a previous life? And I said, no, like in this life. You know, who would think that anybody would have that experience in this life? And right. So I had to go on to explain to him that I had been a Mormon branch president and actually sat on a tribunal and excommunicated somebody, and that was the feeling I was talking about. And of course, everybody in the room, when you talked about that kind of thing, would have thought, well, he's talking about being, you know, something in a previous life. Nobody in this life does that stuff.
Well, I think the idea is that you do so much.
Yeah.
You've done a lot.
Yeah, there was for probably for the purpose of being able to actually have these kinds of conversations, it seems that, you know, my life journey has been one of grabbing for all that you can and then moving to the next day and doing it again. So it's just been the nature of how life, I would say I have lived life, but I think actually in my case life has lived me. And
your life is good too. Yeah,
I got strapped in at an early age, and I've been riding the roller coaster ever since.
Well, so if somebody listening to this is actually part of a company, corporate setting, and you know wants to bring you in to teach, how would they contact you?
You can go to my website, which is very easy. It's alanshelton.com. And on that website is my email, which if you just send me an email message, I get it. I'm very accessible. I have absolutely no urge to create a company or any of those things. I just do my work for corporations and companies that are interested in this style of developmental leadership and also want it done. The additional thing that probably I do that a lot of leadership people don't do is that I've had, you know, a lot of corporate executive experience, and so it's not a problem for me to, you know, communicate and be with some of the higher end executives, as it were. They recognize in my experience that I belong. So and I say that tongue in cheek, because you know the whole point of my book is that credibility is irrelevant. And yet, it actually opens the door for me to tell them it's irrelevant. So, at any rate, but that's how someone would find me, is just, you know, right through the website. I blog and I write and I do, you know, I do these kinds of interviews. A lot of them corporate. I was actually just tickled, to be honest with you, to be able to have this time with you and really be able to play far afield, because I didn't know what we were going to talk about, but I knew it could be anything, and that was pretty fun. So,
well, and we wouldn't have, you know, be complete if I didn't ask you, does sex in any way impinge on this topic?
You know, it doesn't. It's part of this topic. The beauty of the work that one does around sexuality is that it is an exactly resonant with what it is that we're up to. If you feel, for instance, shame is a feeling that one feels around just simply if you think that sexuality is a natural expression of the human body and somebody has shame around that, then they have constructed, if you will, a conditioning or a concept that if they would look through it, they would see they don't have a necessity for it. So a shame-free possibility lies in awareness that the container for shame doesn't really even need to exist or be there. And so what you are doing is exactly the same thing I'm doing. It's just that you're using a different vehicle. And the work that I did in Tantra in India was exactly the same thing. And it broke me through in terms of my conditioning in the same way that a lot of the other processes did. It was a lot of the ingrained feelings and conditionings that I had about sexuality were things that, I got to examine. And I got to see weren't necessary to carry around. And
yeah.
So that was a vital, vital part of the awakening journey, as I call it. So I would say that sexuality and the conditioning around sexuality and the ability to live in the flow of sexuality, which is an absolute natural part of life itself,
right,
is nested in the awakening journey.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I'm so happy that you're putting this positive, growthful, hopeful message out into corporate America, because I think that it's really important that that we move in that direction, so that we're not, predatory towards, life itself on the planet, which is, right now there are definitely some companies that are so predatory, they don't seem to want their own customers to survive.
Agreed. And yet you go to another company, and there's a very large company I work with, and they make all these wonderful, goods for outdoor experience. And when you ask them what they're doing, they'll tell you, we're creating the next generation of conservationists. And that's what make people go in that place. And so you're right. You see a lot of companies that are still stuck in the old place, but then you walk into places and you see people operating from a passion of service and expansion. And you recognize, that there's a big possibility that world can be a place that the most expanded and aware human beings can live in. And the minute you get a whiff of that, it gets pretty exciting.
Well, I think your work is very exciting. And Awaken Leadership, I'm assuming you just go to Amazon.com to get the copy of that?
Yep.
Okay.
It's at Amazon, in the bookstores, all of those places that... It seems to be doing fairly well. As I said, because it's an easier read than a normal business book, I think people like it. So.
Oh, gotcha. It's exciting. It's very exciting. Thank you, Shelton. Alan Shelton, my guest tonight, author of Awakened Leadership. Thanks for joining us in the Shame-Free Zone. It's really been a delight to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And next week, I'm going to be interviewing Sean Bundy. He is from Corvallis, Oregon, actually. The last time I saw Sean, I happened to be presenting at the Oregon State University, which is my alma mater. And he's going to be talking to us about Sperm Brain. That's spermbrain.com is his website. Thanks so much.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak mutus kabar berita?